Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And if you're going to organize to make an appeal to heaven and you want to be open for other people to join you, just let me know. We'll post that just like we have with Loud and Liberty. So if you want to join Loud and Liberty prayer circle on a daily basis, I think it is 11 o'clock Pacific time. The time is up there. I think it goes by Eastern time because that's Loudoun County, Virginia. Anywho, the last thing I have to say is your campaign needs to begin today. I mean, we are so far behind the eight ball in holding our public servants accountable to their oath of office. This is our problem. As a matter of fact, I keep on seeing people complaining. We've been really manipulated and massaged into being rebellious about what we're seeing. And welcome back, Kathy. Or I'm sorry, Tammy. Boy, am I bad with names today or what?
It's all right.
And, you know, I can't say I didn't get enough sleep. Anyway, my point is that when we look at people, we're not capable. I'm just surprised how few people are capable of really critically thinking when they look at a problem. I mean, everybody sees taxation as an evil, but it's a reaction to a cause. The real cause is spending. When government starts spending more and more money, they go, well, we got to increase our taxes. Yeah. Well, so why do people complain about taxes and don't actually question the veracity of what they're spending the money on? And because of that, we find all sorts of states, and we know the federal government, I say it every day, that debt is fraud. Your state debt, what they're spending money on, as a matter of fact, there are some states in real debt. I believe Illinois, California, the real progressive states are spending at breakneck speed, and they're basically creating this hole that is going to be insurmountable by the good people of that state to where they capitulate and or go into conservatorship or what have you. And as a matter of fact, I think what will end up happening is this federal government and its welfare bailing everybody out from the very beginning with the Assumption Act, because we've covered that. Right? I mean, you covered that last summer with me, right? I believe you covered that. Okay, so the Assumption Act was where this federal government assumed the debt of the states. And so we can't do that. We've got to stop subsidizing sin. And that's the whole thing. It's all sin. If you wanted to take a righteous or religious look at this, but I try not to go there because I really value everybody's personal relationship with their creator, whom they worship, what have you. And so, because there's nothing more precious, there is absolutely nothing more precious than a person's relationship with their Savior. So, anywho, got a lot to cover. And as a matter of fact, this has really been weighing on me because, and folks, I know you don't know, but a great patriot, a great woman passed away, tragically and probably, I don't want to say unnecessarily. And as a matter of fact, Tammy, you live in Wyoming. And so what I have found, because, again, this goes back to critical thinking, I have found that people that go move into a development on a shoreline where a developer kind of goes in, whether it be Alabama, Mississippi, and what they do is they clean up the shoreline and clean up, you know, the trees and vegetation and kind of do a little bit of, you know, I don't want to say landscaping, but terrainscaping to make it look like a really appealing area. And they put up all these houses. Now, almost all of these houses are right there in what we call the high storm wave action. And the high storm wave action is when a storm comes and hits, there's this huge surge of water that goes well beyond its normal wave action. And so when you look at an undeveloped area of beach, you can actually see multiple lines. You can see the normal wave action, a storm wave action, and then a high storm where, you know, it's not just a basic storm where the waves are a little bit higher than usual. This is where you've got a lot of force, like with Katrina. And with Katrina, there were many of the houses that were overcome by the immensity of that wave storm action. Even the houses up on stilts, because it was just a little bit higher than they anticipated. And so when people go in and buy a home, and this happens in California, it doesn't matter where, 9 times out of 10, they realize that they have to pay a really high premium for their insurance. They say, well, why is this? And they, well, that's because you're in a, you know, a storm area that you could sustain some real damage. Now, keep in mind that these insurance companies, it's kind of like an at-will relationship. I mean, you're looking for somebody and they're willing to actually cover you. At any point in time, you can sever that relationship and you can go somewhere else and get cheaper insurance or more expensive insurance, more comprehensive, what have you. And on the flip side, that insurance company can cancel their insurance coverage for you, right? And that's actually something that just happened. Now, this is this is kind of all overarching, but I wanted to get into some points because, we need to start thinking better, folks. This good friend, who I've only met once, and I know you've worked with her quite a bit, and I don't necessarily want to go down the path of diving into the personal information or anything, but when I speak to Tammy, I can ask Tammy for your perspective. When you moved into Wyoming, the idea of ambulatory care and, you know, being able to have somebody with training come and react to a medical condition that is, you know, life-threatening. In other words, you know, a heart condition, you know, pulmonary condition, something like that. Do you think about where you live and the services that might be available? Because I think most of the people that moved to Wyoming for decades and decades over the past century and a half, two centuries, I don't think people move there because of government services.
I mean, yeah, if you have a lot of medical issues.
Yes. And so my point is,
moving to this area is not, especially where I live, moving to this area is not probably somewhere you would move.
Somewhere where you shouldn't move. If you've got a pulmonary, heart condition, anything where you have medical needs, it is, you know, a place that you're taking on a risk that, you know, you're going to die. Yeah. And I'll be frank, you're just going to die because you don't have the same type of services that you might have available in a very good, well-funded government municipality. Where, you know, ambulatory care is very responsive. The police are very responsive. I mean, most people complain in the suburbs because police are never responsive. But in the cities, usually they have much better coverage because the crime rate is much higher. You know, it's happening all the time. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so my question, or I guess the thing I have to point out is, as I'm looking at what's going on in California, what happened in Hawaii, what happened in North Carolina, we as communities are not built as communities anymore because we're not working together to say, okay, what are the risks we're going to have? I mean, how many communities in California, because nobody knows each other, I mean, we've become a disassociated society where we have this huge mutual dependency on each other. And I talked about this on Monday, and I'm not sure if you heard my show Monday, but where you may be a butcher, and you're making a living out of, you know, carving up meat. And so you are dependent on the baker to make your bread and your cakes and muffins and, you know, your baked goods. And you're depending on somebody to grow the green and the vegetables for, you know, I'm thinking that you may actually on occasion have vegetables, a salad. You know, we're going to presume that the people that do are butchers, they love meat. But that's not necessarily the case. But my point was back in the beginning of this nation, everybody was really self-sufficient. They didn't go into a very specific trade. They just, you know, muddled through in killing their own cattle and, you know, whatever meat spoiled, they lost that, or, you know, but they learned as they went along. And the same thing, I mean, especially if you're kind of thrown into, you know, livestock. You've never done it before. You've raised, you know, your father and mother and your family's always raised crops. And, you kind of go out and get some cow or goats or what have you. Anyway, my point is that the interdependency is so deep today that people can't fix their own cars, that people can't do much for themselves. That they offer a specific trade and or a service because they've focused on that. And we've, with a good society, one doesn't have to worry about, you know, are these common threads that bind us together in this symbiotic relationship, mutually benefiting relationship. But
my sister and I call those man skills.
Okay. Man skills. I consider them survival skills. And as a matter of fact, I've seen catalogs because in Wyoming, women had to do a lot of things that the men, you know, because they had to share the responsibilities. I mean, it's kind of like what I would think back in Moses' days when you were out there. I mean, that may have been one of the reasons why they had, you know, husbands had multiple wives. I dare I go there. But I mean, the industry of the family was critical to the survival of the family. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So I'm not trying to be judgmental. I'm not trying to stir up contention, but it's kind of weighs on me to go, wow, we as Americans don't appreciate, you know, what we have and what we need to do to, what we need to do to keep it. Because there are lots of things that we want government to do that government should do. And there are a lot of things that we have government do that government really shouldn't do. Would we be better off if we had, if we maintained a relationship, not a symbiotic or a direct relationship, but at least maintain a relationship with the communities and churches to take care of compassionate services? Had the government not stepped in and said, we're going to create a welfare system and we're going to basically, you know, not judge people and we're going to give you money because you're entitled to it, and creating the entitlement state. All this being unconstitutional, and prior to them doing this, it was kind of really left to the churches. Now, I wrote this in my first book that in the 1820s, when the evangelical church started rising up and the concept of a traveling church, you know, came to be in the 1820s, this was called the Second Awakening in America. And the evangelical movement was central to that. And the evangelical movement, what it literally did was it created a temporary competition for people's attention and money, because the churches would come into town and they would perform miracles and people would be, you know, bamboozled or what have you by the snake oil salesman, and they would throw their money into the, you know, to the hats or the little baskets, whatever they were passing around, and they were contributing. Oh, this is, and they would go get blessed and no miracle in their life. And the next day or however long that troop was there, once they felt that they, you know, people would start catching on like a bunch of, you know, shifty car salesmen, they packed up and they left. And so when all of a sudden everybody was really hurting, because I pointed this out, they didn't have banks that had a commuting of currency on a regular basis to where the banks were able to maintain input, because everything was done by shoestrings back then. So when that money left, when those gold and silver coins left in the evangelicals' hands to go to the next town far away, there was nothing left in the town. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so when we kind of look at how this was happening, we can see how compassionate services went out the window, because when people actually needed help and they went to, because in those days, most of the churches were layman churches. As a matter of fact, John Adams talks about his father being a way leader in Massachusetts, and how, you know, they didn't, it wasn't a profession. They didn't make money off of it. The evangelical movement brought money into it. It's kind of like a New Age version of the Catholic Church, where this became a profession. That's all you did. You didn't. And John Adams' father was a cobbler. He made shoes. So that's how he supported his family, along with some other industrious things that they did. But my point is that there was this huge shift where all of a sudden the clergy became soul, you know, it became their source of income. Right, wrong, or indifferent, this really created this major shift that over time, more and more churches became more focused on, you know, competing the word and basically a proselyte full-time and those types of things, to where the compassionate services actually started going by the wayside, because, you know, you got to pay your rent. You know, when all of a sudden this is how you make your money. And as a matter of fact, I mean, have you not ever witnessed how, you know, some of the preachers in some communities have the nicest cars? You ever seen that?
Yeah. Oh, okay. I personally have not witnessed that.
Oh, okay. So I have. And so all things being equal, what we see is that the communities kind of were decimated by this shift, or this paradigm shift, that the churches were undergoing. And so in the compassionate services, the government, because you got to remember that the churches took care of healthcare, they took care of education, they took care of, you know, kind of like employment training and or helping people, you know, get jobs, you know, sustain themselves, what have you. So the churches were very integral in our society. As a matter of fact, did you read the cod fishery bounties with me last year?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, and remember when Madison used a shock value in saying, hey, if we allow the government to start using money on anything that they want, then they're going to take over education. And everybody, you know, at least I believe he was using that as a shock value, that they're going to take over religion. And this was reaching the level of absurdity, but he was proving a point, that there's no limit to what government would do. And even though some of the people could not even fathom what he was saying, that's impossible. Look at today, where they've actually created laws that say, thou shalt not teach creation. Thou shalt worship evolution, that we evolved, and our sciences that we give you, the secular godless church that they create. So anyway, I've spent a lot of time on this topic, and there's actually another one I wanted to talk about. I don't know why, but I would wish people would actually start looking, and the suggestion hint for everybody is, when's the last time you had a community meeting? When is the last time you all actually put things on the table where, you know, some people say, I want to be taken care of? Well, then you're living in the wrong place. Because bottom line, when you ask government to provide these things for you, and as a matter of fact, the reason I brought up our mutual friend, associate more for me, I guess, because I never really broke bread or anything like that with her and her family, but I've worked with them a little bit. And I can't, knowing the type of patriot she would have been an ardent opposer to growing government services. Do you not agree?
Oh, yeah.
And so, I mean, she wanted to not be, I mean, she hated taxes and government spending. And she was where, you know, if there was that community meeting, she would be the one poking people in the eye. Are you kidding me? I'm not going to pay for that. I don't want to pay for that. You know, we have to be adults and accept the risks that come with where we live.
Yeah.
And so when is the last time? So this is the question I'm posing because I want to plant this. When's the last time your community actually had a meeting where you talked about the real frankness of your environment? What are the risks that you're really facing that you need to talk about and say, you know what? I'm okay with those things, but this is what we need to do to maybe provide for ourselves. There's no reason why, other than, you know, there may be members of the community that may be shysters, but there's no reason why people can't pull resources to at least have something for emergency purposes. You know, in other words, I know some communities have ham radios for emergency purposes so that they can communicate because your communications may be completely down. But you, with a ham radio, you can reach a far distance away and say, hey, we need to get the word out. What the heck's happening here? And so, you know, those types of things. And ham radios are not necessarily expensive. They're not cheap, but it's not something that a group of people can't actually create. Now, I happen to be in a state that has collectivism that's written all over it. And they have this thing called a grange. Now, a grange is a community building that they make to basically tend to, and so the people can meet and have, you know, meetings and get organized for their crops that they're growing, for their livestock and those types of things. And so there's usually these grange places that, you know, provide even the services. But this is where the people kind of pull together. I remember when I was a child and we moved into an area where there was a grange, and the grange had this huge, this is before refrigeration was really common and where people could afford it or where people didn't even have electricity in some of the areas. And so, because this was a mountainous area. And so the grange had this huge freezer with lockers in it so people could go buy meat and put it in their freezer there. And then you just have to plan, you know, the time to go get it for your meal or what have you, to thaw it out and all of that. And I mean, so they did things like that. Communities really need to put their thinking caps on and figure out what they need and what they have to do to, you know, to deal with these types of emergencies, because nobody ever thought that their own government would actually be going after them to kill them and destroy their property. And yet, look at what's happened to Hawaii. Look at what's happened on the East Coast with Milton's. And the evidence is becoming overwhelming that these things are being done by tools that the government uses and controls.
Mm-hmm.
So, folks, you better start having some meetings. You better actually start being frank and honest. And actually, I would highly recommend, if you have any religious inclination, start with the, you know, an invocation and end with a benediction. You know, to try to have the spirit with you so that you can have productive meetings, but you've got to do that. Now, when we come back, sorry, Tammy, we've got only a minute left. So when we come back from the break, I want to talk about my next project, because I know I sent it to you and you're looking at it. And this is a project of awakening the state legislature to take back the Senate. So most people think that, oh, this is going to be so hard. We've got to undo the 17th Amendment. And so I know you read it and you need to read it again. But now I can talk a little bit in detail so that when we come back, you can help me, because I know I probably need to put this into layman's terms. And so I started to kind of organize it. But bottom line, I need people to start demanding that their state legislatures start controlling their senators. Now, when we come back, I did a little bit of analysis on this, and I looked at how many states. And so when we start off, I want to actually go through a little survey of how many conservative or Republican-controlled states actually have how many Democratic senators represent those now Republican-controlled legislatures. And this is mind-blowing, because when we look at, you know, if the state legislatures took over I mean, it would be pretty overwhelming. So anyway, when we come back, we will dive into taking back the Senate. Then we're going to get into the Second Reconstruction Act. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so welcome back, folks, and welcome back, Tammy. Let me be to the point. So I sent Tammy and a few people in Wyoming because we're trying to get the attention of the Senate and actually the entire legislature in reviewing the Constitution. And so, and actually doing an audit on it, very specifically, right? I mean, that's the bill mm-hmm. that we, and as a matter of fact, Chairman Ethorn used the term republic review. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, and I think that was kind of common in tandem with the bill. But all that being said, I sent an argument because we're so illiterate regarding the Constitution that there is not one state legislature, and I'm not even hearing a single legislator. Now, if you know a legislator that is harping on this, then please let me know, because I want to help. I want to work with everybody that wants to take back their government and get control of it and get it back aligned with the Constitution. So I say this because why is it? It's almost like the Department of Transportation, right? We have that little video that proves three presidents, Madison, Monroe, and Jackson, all vetoed congressional attempts to use the federal government to tax and spend money on improving highways and waterways, not even, you know, creating and managing a system, but to just improve existing ones. And so they all said that that power, for to be involved in infrastructure, that power does not exist in the Constitution. You must amend it. Now, I've said this. Why is it, out of all of the patriotic organizations out there, from health freedom to the Second Amendment to abortion, there's a gamut, a huge gamut of people that are standing up against the tyranny. Western Lands Group, right? So, and I would pale to try to compare all of them or actually mention all of them. My point is this: how come there's not one that is demanding the dismantling of the Department of Transportation? I mean, we have irrefutable proof that Madison, Monroe, and Jackson all said that that power doesn't exist in the Constitution. That's not, you know, it's not just casual conversation that somebody just picked up on. These were communications to Congress to say that power doesn't exist, and the only way you can do this is by amending the Constitution legitimately. And even Madison, in his veto statement, said, even if the states allow you to do it, it'll always be a violation. At any point in time, they can take it back. We got to do this right. We've got to amend the Constitution. And this is my point, because when we look at Trump, and if Trump dismantles the Department of Education, don't applaud him. It's not his job to do that. It's his job to get the states to do that, because if he does it, then the next president come along, well, he did something that was bad. We want this Department of Education. And then they'll rebuild it and they'll make it even more evil.
Right.
And so that's what happens when we literally watch this cesspool of compromise go back and forth, because it never bodes well for us, the people. So anyway, there's not one patriot organization out there that is even bringing forward this irrefutable argument that the Department of Transportation is unconstitutional. And the reason why is because if they did that, then it would actually prove that the possession of Western lands. I mean, now that it lays out the argument that they can only do those things enumerated, then it would shut down the federal government's ability to do food, agriculture, the parks and range, you know, or I should say parks, forests, those types of things. I mean, the closure of government would be stupefying, because labor, housing, healthcare, I mean, there's all education. There's all of these things that are not enumerated at all that they've assumed. That one argument that they can't do it because it's not enumerated would literally close everybody down. Or it would be the initial wake up for everybody to go, well, then if that's true, then the rest of this stuff's got to go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So my point is this, is that because nobody is even doing that, I find it interesting that there's not one state legislator in any of the legislatures that are demanding and haranguing and demanding that the state legislature start demanding its suffrage out of their Senate. Everybody seems to be, and it's almost like we've been brainwashed that the 17th Amendment did this to us. So the point behind what I sent you was to prove that the 17th Amendment only changed two things in the Constitution. And so when you look at it, I kind of lay out in the very first part in the document, I lay out what is, and I paraphrase, what is actually in Article 1 referring to senators. It establishes their term. It establishes how they're chosen. It establishes the classes, that there'll be three classes, so that you won't have a complete turnover of the Senate at any point in time. You'll only change over one-third at a time. So the point is, and maybe this is important, but the point is that there were only two things that were actually, there was three things highlighted. Two things that were highlighted was a part of the 17th Amendment, the blue highlight and the yellow highlight. The red highlight is a part because the Senate and the House had the responsibility of controlling the behavior of their own people. They, in other words, the Senate wouldn't go down into the House and get into their laundry, and the House wouldn't get into the Senate's dirty laundry. They would have autonomy. So in other words, they created two dens of thieves, that they were honorable people, that, you know, there would be this honor amongst thieves once the thieves took over. And that's exactly what we have. But the highlight of that is the fact that the 14th Amendment actually changed that. They don't have the ability to not do anything. The 14th Amendment, being the supreme law of the land, demands that when a senator or representative violates their oath of office, that the Senate is obligated to get that senator out of there. And the same thing with the House of Representatives. And so this is one thing that I can't believe people aren't haranguing our government and public servants on. But going back to the suffrage, there is nowhere in Article 1 where the state suffrage is protected. When I mean state suffrage, and I think I alluded to this before, that when we look at a representative government, and this is why I go over and over and over trying to help you understand that our representation of government is that of sovereigns, that the House represents the sovereignty of the people and their interests. And so in the House of Representatives at the state and the House of Representatives at the federal level, those people who are representing you are trying to make sure that they're taking care of their constituents. So when you look at a representative, they may have 30,000, they may have a million, they may have 40,000, whatever it is in the state and whatever it is at the federal level, it's not a single voice, right? The point is that they've got a lot of constituents to try to take care of. And did I use this argument with the gun? I may have, but I don't think I don't think I've stated this. So let's just say your representative in Congress is going to have to decide, because I'm going to keep on this federal constitutionality. In other words, if your representative in the House of Representatives is voting on an issue that's unconstitutional, every person in that district should be calling them out. But nobody even understands what's constitutional. However, we do have a lot of gun advocates and so forth. And let's say, because the standards of the militia and or the military is clearly Congress's responsibility. So if your representative is trying to determine what the new handgun would be for the militia, i.e. the military, what is the standard for the handgun, and what would be the standard for the long rifle for the lower-ranked infantry? The handgun is the TO weapon for staff officers, staff enlisted and officers. So it's higher enlisted. And so that's why they have so many privates and, all the bulk of the rank is the lower ranks, because they're the ones that are actually pulling the triggers with the long rifles. And that's the infantry. And they have a little bit of leadership of both officers and staff. But anyway, the point is, they're now going to reconsider the long gun and the handgun. So technically, the people of that legislator or congressman should actually be reaching in and saying, hey, you need to go with this gun because we think this is the best gun because we make it here, or because we find it's the best tactical weapon, what have you. And so the point is that representative has a consensus. It is not singular. It's not like all of the people in the congressional district or all of the people in the legislative district called each other and they all agreed that it would be this one thing. And so they all basically said, this is what you must do. Because if you understand that, then that representative, because he's representing you, his hands are tied, that's what he should be supporting. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. So 9 times out of 10 and almost 100% of the time, there is never a clear direction for your representatives in the House, which is kind of why they've been relegated to just cover real general things that are enumerated. But bottom line, if it's something that they shouldn't be doing, like energy, housing, and all of these types of things, we all should be basically, drop them. Not bombs, but, faxes and emails and calls and say, look, you could not do this. That's unconstitutional. Now, with the Senate, it's different. See, the senators in the Senate, in the U.S. Senate, represent the state. And when we say the state, when we look there specifically, we understand that to be the state legislature because they were the ones that were to appoint. Now, because in the late 1800s, early 1900s, there were states that were deliberately not appointing their senators, and the Senate was not getting quorum, and they were having problems. This was a progressive move. This was being done on purpose so that they could shift the appointment. The only resolution was to have the voters choose the representatives for the state legislature. That's all they did. When you read the 17th Amendment, both sections deal, once the first section deals with the original appointing, it repeats some of the language that, they'll serve one term or their term will be 6 years or what have you. It repeats some of the language, but the change is that they will now be elected by the people instead of the legislature. Then the second paragraph of the 17th Amendment basically lays out that if a senator is removed or has to be replaced, instead of going to the state legislature, they go to the governor, and the governor will either appoint, if the state legislature allows that, or the governor will set up an election to basically replace the person via an election by the people. That's all the 17th Amendment did. If you read the 17th Amendment, which I included there, there's not one mention of suffrage in the Senate, that the states will have their equal suffrage in the Senate. Now, this is really important. This is why I've taken an aside off of this Reconstruction. So we may not get into the Reconstruction today because this is really, really important. So when the state legislature appointed their own, they had suffrage, and technically the state legislature had the ability to tell them exactly how to vote. The problem was that they didn't have real time. In other words, it took a long time for whatever was coming up on a treaty or what have you. There was not enough time to go and inform the state legislature because they may not even have been in session. So they could, you know, hey, we got this treaty and we need to talk to the state legislature. So bottom line, they were accountable for how they voted. Technically, they were supposed to be voting the way they wanted them to. But because of this disconnect, they were really serving as proxy with good instructions as to how to behave. Now, they knew that this was a problem, and so the solution was to change the paradigm of how these guys were selected. By doing so, there's this old adage, he who pays the piper calls the tune, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there is this direct association to those, because prior to that, there was no money involved in the selection of a senator, at least not the conventional campaign type of money. And so, you know, there was a state legislature that you had to buy off to get this guy appointed. And so it was very, very difficult to do that and to have that level of control. So they said, well, we need to change this. And what we want to do is actually create a facade that makes everybody believe that now that the people are appointing the senators, that they now have to respond because they represent the people. When actually, that did not change. The 17th Amendment did not change who they were representing. So moving on in that little document I gave you, I identified the three things that are senators' responsibilities in Article 2. I didn't go through Article 3 because that's just a joint Congress, that Congress has these controls. So I just didn't include that because that's not unique to the senator. I only identified all things unique to Senate and the senators. Mm-hmm. And so then I pointed out the language of Article 5. And the fact is, there was no identifying the change in the 17th Amendment to touching Article 5. And here's the important thing. Article 5, that clause is an amendment protection clause. In other words, it would be unconstitutional for any state or for Congress to recommend an amendment that would take away the state legislators' suffrage in the Senate, because that's what that states. It says, providing that no amendment be passed that would do two things. In other words, this was a forbidden zone for two types of amendments. The first amendment was the amendment of the slave trade, shutting down the slave trade in 1808. They didn't want the South. They didn't want, you know, this movement of a compromise that they'll not end the slave trade, that they'll allow it to continue by amending out Article 1, Section 9, where it calls for the end of the slave trade and the importation of persons. So that was a hard fix. You cannot amend the Constitution to touch that. The other one, you cannot amend the Constitution to touch the state legislature's suffrage in the Senate. Now, when they mentioned the state's equal suffrage in the Senate, that was referring to specifically the state legislature, because that's who the senators were representing. That was very clear in both the Constitutional Convention as well as the ratification debates, that the state legislature would have their representation in the Senate. And the people had their representation in the House. So when we look at the 17th Amendment, the fact that it couldn't touch that suffrage, and the fact that that suffrage is still a legal binding requirement, Okay. And mm-hmm. today we don't live in the dark ages where we don't have mm-hmm. any idea what the Senate is doing right now. We actually right. have the ability to see what they're saying, hear what they're saying, and actually be able to pick up a phone and say, you better just take that back right now while you're still up there. Say, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say that. I mean, we actually have that kind of ability if we could actually, you know, force these guys to have little earpieces to say, stop that. You know, to have that level of control. To be clear, when the state legislature, so here's the huge difference between the Senate and the House. The House has to contend with all of their constituents. What are the constituents for a senator? It's one. The state legislature, they vote on, you know, how they want to see, you know, do they want this treaty to pass or not? Yes or no? You will vote against that treaty. It's a unison. It's not like they're going to take a consensus among them and then decide for themselves. No, the state legislature by the House and the Senate will actually nine times always, I'm just going to say, it's usually in the state's interest to agree, but I can't ever see how you'd have a split vote where you'd give that senator latitude. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
Because it's either yes or no. It's either vote for it or vote against it. Vote for the Supreme Court justice or vote against the Supreme Court justice every time it comes up to vote. In other words, the marching orders in today's real-time world we live would be locked down. Now, this when they put the 17th Amendment out, they didn't even know we would get to this point. They just wanted to have the ambiguity for these guys to do the evil work of the globalists. And now it's very obvious that the Senate is absolutely the chamber controlled and owned by the globalists. If you understand the premise and you understand the constitutionality of one, Article 5, and the lack of the changing in the amendment, the lack of the language of actually changing that suffrage, because they couldn't do it. And the fact is, this is immutable. This is irrefutable. You cannot actually see this any other way. If the state legislatures today actually took a stand and said, you will or we will remove you for violating Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, because every senator is required to support the Constitution. And in other words, they are supposed to actually give the suffrage to the state legislature. And so the state legislature could then charge them for violating Section 3. And all they need to do is one thing. They can consider that a felony for removal of office, not a crime. In other words, if they make it a felony, and if you look at Article 4, Section 2 of the Constitution, you'll actually find the language in that allows the state legislature and or the state themselves to extradite. What it says is a person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime, violation of the Constitution, not treason, but violating their oath of office could be either considered a felony. Or they could consider it, I think that technically that's what it has to be, is a felony. But you just don't serve any sentence. You're just removed. And not only are you removed, but you're banned for life, because that's what Section 3 demands. You will be branded as no longer ever able to work in the public sector for profit and or, help me out here. Nevertheless, they are banned from public service, period. All types of public service. And so, am I making sense, or am I just confusing you?
I mean, it makes sense, but it's also confusing.
Okay. So, how hard would it be for Montana, Wyoming? And so here's the point, and actually let me back up to why this was important in communicating this the past weekend, and I think this is the epiphany, because if we got the state legislature, and if I got people to actually review, do an audit, and become thoroughly profound in understanding the Constitution, that's a better word, if I can get the state legislature and those legislators on this committee to have a profound understanding of the Constitution, then they would quickly take back their suffrage and they would start changing the demeanor in the Senate. They
would,
To put it into social media terms, the state legislature would be very mindful, very demure, very direct and deliberate in helping those senators understand that they either give them their suffrage or suffer the consequences. Because you only need, I truly believe, you only need to remove one or two that will actually make a difference. Now, why is this so important? Because last night I had a Missouri meeting, and last night we were actually going through the states that had, red states that actually had legislators that were, and keep in mind, folks, that you may have a blue state, but that's only because of the Senate. And I believe Virginia, I think, is one of those states. Let me confirm it real quick. By the way, if you want to actually see a great website that will give you the makeup of a state legislature, because understanding the footing throughout the Republic is really important. And so when you look at Virginia, the Senate is barely Democrat, and the Democrats are barely Democrat in Virginia. What is the state? I think it's Nevada. No, it's not Nevada. It was one of these.
What's the website?
It is Statescape. I'm sorry, Statescape. StateScape.com. And so, yeah, so when we look at some of these split houses, we'll actually find that the Minnesota is a split house. And when we look at the Senate as not being split, but it's still a one-person split, in the last election, a lot of houses shifted more red. Minnesota was one of those houses that shifted more red. They're considered a, you know, a blue state because they have one more senator, but they actually have one more representative that is Republican, one more senator that's Democrat. So technically they're split. And actually, they actually view them as a yellow, not a red or blue. So they're kind of undecided. But my point is, I believe that Minnesota is kind of fed up with the liberalism that they've been dealing with. And I believe that in the next election, if done right and held right, they will actually flip further where they'll be replacing more of their Senate. Because you don't replace the Senate every 2 years. You do that with the House. The Senate in the state level is every 4 years. So it takes 4 years to actually see the outcome shift. And I believe that that may actually transform, or that may actually come to be in the 2026 election. When we look at the same thing with Michigan, Michigan has 58 to 52 now. And I believe that that Senate will shift because right now it's 20 to 18, 20 Democrat, 18. So my point is, as we start looking at these representatives, and let me kind of fly through, actually, I don't even have time. We're out of time. So tomorrow, I'm going to go through the states that actually, red states that have Democratic, red states that have Democratic senators. And I would love to see these state legislatures, just fathom this, the state legislatures are telling those Democrats exactly how to vote, and watch what they do and see how they behave, because this is where we can extract our pound of flesh in demanding compliance of the Constitution. Because they're going to be squealing all the way home like a pig, you know, being hurt. But the fact is, folks, the state legislatures have control over that Senate. Whether anybody likes that or not, that was the design. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.